You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1998 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the first class in a series given by Brother George Booker titled, The Story of Ruth.
During this class period, we'll be talking about Ruth. The story of Ruth is a small story. It has no worldwide flood in which millions of people perish. There is no epic pilgrimage of millions of people out of Egyptian slavery. No nations rise or fall in the book of Ruth. For that matter, there isn't even a great ocean liner colliding with an iceberg or a huge asteroid threatening the world. Nothing like that. The book of Ruth, the story of Ruth, is small, very personal, almost private. It is, perhaps, very much like our own personal stories. So we approach it in that way, as a personal story, as a reminiscence. What we're going to do in the class, among other things, is we're going to allow our imagination some freedom. And we're going to let Ruth tell us her own story in her own words. There may be times when Ruth is telling us her story that you might like to sit with your eyes closed, and that's fine. You might doze off, and that's okay, too, because we can't really tell. If you start snoring, we'll wake you up because others might still be listening. And you're under no obligation to close your eyes. Some people are afraid that someone might sneak up on them if they close their eyes. So that's entirely up to you. I should emphasize that in telling the story of Ruth this way, certain poetic license is allowed, and we cannot be sure in every instance that this is just how the story went, but this is how it might have been.
They put the sleeping bundle of life into my arms, and as I gazed upon him through aged eyes, I remembered another baby a long, long time ago. I, the new mother, had placed my son in another pair of old arms. And I remembered how Naomi's face had glowed with joy at the sight of him, my little Obed. And now, much greater in years than Naomi had been, I, Ruth, widow of Boaz, held my seventh great-grandson, David. And I remember. Naomi had told me that the trip from Bethlehem in the land of Israel to the country of Moab had been a long and difficult journey. They had been a family of four in those days, Elimelech, Naomi, and two sons, Chilion and Mahlon. Times had been bad in Israel. There had been drought, followed by famine, and disease and death had come close behind. Bethlehem in Judah, known as the house of bread in the past, had become as dried up as an old crust of bread. Men sat at the city gate discussing the situation day after day. No longer did they spend busy days in the shops or the fields. Women went to the well, once filled with cool, pure water, and returned home with just a small quantity of the precious liquid. The children, too, were changed by the conditions. There were no longer joyful, noisy trips to the fields to help with the planting or harvesting. They didn't seem to have the energy to play very long in the streets anymore. The old and the very young were the first to die. The rest lingered on, growing thinner and weaker by the day. Parents save their meager portions of bread and water for dried food for the children. And after a while, they remember Moses' words. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commandments. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you are not obedient, and if you are drawn away to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day you will certainly be destroyed. I will set my face against you. I will punish you for your sins 7 times over. I will break down your stubborn pride and make the sky above you like iron and the ground beneath you like bronze. Your strength will be spent in vain because your soil will not yield its crops, nor will the trees of the land yield their fruit. Had not every man and woman been doing that which was right in his or her own eyes? And now God was doing what was right in his eyes. But he did not leave his people without hope. He constantly called to them to return to him so that he would return to them. If only they would listen. Yes, life in Bethlehem was coming to a halt, just as it was in other parts of the land. There was no joy and gladness, no voices of bride and bridegroom, nor grinding of the millstones here. Travelers brought the news that other countries to the east of the Jordan River had bountiful crops, fast-flowing streams, and work. Elimelech and Naomi had spent many restless nights in the muggy heat discussing the problem. The land of Israel was where they belonged, but the land of Israel was now struck down by drought and famine. What should they do? Where should they go? Indeed, should they go? Had not Father Abram gone to Egypt during famine? And Jacob? He too had moved all his family to Egypt during another time of famine. Sleep brought little refreshment, and each day the problems grew worse. And so, eventually, the near empty vessels in the house and 2 hungry, growing boys forced Elimelech's decision. They would leave for Moab immediately. As I told you, the trip was long. The sun beat down from a cloudless blue sky. Villages lay shimmering in endless heat with few sounds of life. Crops were blasted with desert winds. The earth was parched and cracked. Vultures circled on hot, dry wind currents, black, forbidding prophets of doom. They, of all God's creatures, could always find food. The family trudged northeast and down to the Jordan River, where they easily crossed the shallow waters. Here, where once Joshua and Israel had seen the deep waters rolled back by God's power, they now walked with the trip waters splashing at their ankles. On through the arid Israelitish territories of Gad and Reuben, and south into lush Moab, which seemed now to be the true land of milk and honey.
As we go along with our story, we'll be looking at other Bible passages and offering thoughts and comments and exhortations. On the board, I have written a number of Bible passages. Some of those I'll be referring to, and so this may save us time in looking them up. I'll be looking them up as I read them. Others I may just skip over, depending on the amount of time that we have. If I'm skipping certain passages and you notice them on the board, you might just jot them down for later because they generally relate to the same topic of what I'm discussing at that point in time, too. So that's just a device to help us as we move through the story. During a time of great trial, Elimelech and his wife Naomi leave the land of promise. Were they justified in doing so? Should we judge them? Should we condemn them for their failure? We don't really know all the circumstances. We've imagined, to some extent, what they might have been. We do know that others remained behind in the land of Israel and lived through the worst of times and prospered. So that seems as though it would have been a possibility. Also, in Abraham's experiences, leaving the land of promise created all sorts of difficulties and problems. So, we're left to wonder. It seems it was a downward step, and there were sad and then finally tragic circumstances and consequences that resulted. It is almost always so when one leaves the place and the company of fellow believers and goes out into a wider world. Notice the downward progression of the story, and we'll look at the first couple of verses of the book of Ruth. In verse 1, we are told that they went to sojourn in the land of Moab, or the New International Version, which I'll be reading to a large extent, says, they went to live for a while, suggesting that, at least at the beginning, they thought of it as a temporary visit or a temporary time to be spent in Moab. In verse 2, we are told that they continued there. The NIV says they lived there. And then finally, in verse 4, the two sons of Elimelech and Naomi married Moabite women. So there are several steps in this downward progression. Some of the references on the board, Genesis 13 and 14 and 19, call our attention to the story of Lot, who made a similar downward spiral. First of all, Lot beheld the land of Sodom, that it was well watered and fertile. That's Genesis 13, verse 10. Then, Genesis 13, verse 12 says that Lot pitches his tent near Sodom, not yet in Sodom, but near there. Finally, Genesis 14, verse 12, Lot and his family dwell in Sodom, another step downward, another step further away, until finally, Genesis 19, verse 1, Lot sits in the gate of the city of Sodom as though he were one of the elders or the leaders of the city. The same sort of downward progression is portrayed in a negative sense in Psalm 1, verse 1. And I think, you know, these are verses worthy of our consideration as exhortations. Psalm 1, verse 1 reads as follows. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers. And it's worth thinking about this verse in two different ways. As it's stated here, this is a verse of blessing. And in fact, it could absolutely be true only of one man, the Lord Jesus Christ, the one who was truly blessed because he never walked in the counsel of the wicked. He never stood in the way of sinners. He never sat in the seat of mockers. But if we remove the negatives, we have another statement of that same sort of downward progression, step by step, tentatively moving closer, then a little closer again, until finally one is completely engulfed or enmeshed in the ways and the world of the wicked. So look at it in that way. Cursed is the man, and we turn it around as I said, cursed is the man, to be judged is the man who does walk in the counsel of the wicked, who does stand in the way of sinners, and who does finally sit in the seat of mockers. And we see how the progression becomes more and more complete until finally there is a total involvement with the mockers of the world, with the way of the wicked. Something like this seems to have been happening in the story of Elimelech and Naomi. Moab was a land of idolatry. It was a land close in miles, only about 30 miles away from parts of Israel. Close in miles, but remote in mind. It was a completely different world. Moab was situated east and southeast of the Dead Sea and occupied a stretch of land about 50 miles long by 30 miles wide. It had high tablelands that were very fertile. Wonderful crops of wheat could be grown there. There were great pasture lands for the producing of cattle. The soil was extremely fertile. It was, in that sense, a very attractive land. And because it was on a high plateau, it was easily seen from most parts of Israel. So that at a time of famine, those who were suffering in Israel could look out across the Dead Sea and in the distance see a beautiful and green land. Or so it would seem. But Moab was one of Israel's most unrelenting enemies. The word Moab signifies one derived from a father, that is, one born according to the flesh. Moab was the son of Lot's elder daughter and was conceived through incest, as described in Genesis 19, verse 37. The Moabites were known for their hostility toward Israel. A king of Moab hired the false prophet Balaam to curse Israel, Numbers 22. And when this failed, then the daughters of Moab caused the men of Israel to commit fornication and bow down to pagan gods, Numbers 25. Because of the unceasing hostility of the nation of Moab toward Israel, a Moabite was prohibited entrance into the congregation of Israel, according to Deuteronomy 23. Those first verses of Deuteronomy 23 will be occupying our attentions a bit further on in our consideration of the story of Ruth. To the Hebrews, therefore, Moab was the land of sin and death. The dominant idol of Moab was Chemosh, called an abomination, whose worship was characterized, according to some scholars and historians, by the sacrifice of small children on a fiery altar. The irony is this, that Elimelech's family went down to Moab to be safe and prosperous, but all of the men died. Man proposes, but God disposes. And as we're told in Proverbs 16, verse 33, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. What we propose, what we expect, what we plan is not necessarily the way things really turn out. And we see that in the story of Ruth.
It didn't take long for them to settle into a new village with a new house and friends. They did miss the trip to Shiloh to the tabernacle with its feasts and sacrifices. The Moabites also worshipped one god, but it was the idol Chemosh. The god of Israel was unknown to them, except for legends they had heard long ago about the mighty God who brought Israel out of Egyptian slavery after sending terrible plagues upon the Egyptians. About the crossing of the Red Sea and of various wilderness happenings. Legends, of course. The Moabites could see no problem. Moab and Israel had one god each. It wasn't important which one was worshipped. Life was to be enjoyed. There were more than a few Israelites in the area, and they would meet and talk about the old days in their homeland. Feast days were kept as best they could, but it was not like the former days. Word spread about continuing hard times in the land of Israel. People no longer talked of returning. They were comfortable in Moab. Some had new, prospering businesses. Some built larger homes and barns. Crops and water were plentiful. Babies were born, and older children turned into young men and women. There were weddings, feasts, and happy times for Israelites and Moabites together. It was at one of these weddings that I met the Israelite family of Elimelech. My friend Orpah was marrying Elimelech and Naomi's son, Chilion. The bridegroom's brother, Mahlon, was plainly enjoying the music, dancing, and companionship. But he also took time to serve the main guests. As I reached for a piece of sweet raisin bread from the tray which he carried, our eyes met for the first time. His arm brushed lightly against my own. I, Ruth, a Moabitess, and this man, Mahlon, son of Israel, were suddenly and instantly drawn together. And so it was that from week to week, he would come to visit my brothers, but he always found more time to spend with me. We would talk about his family, his dreams, his work, and his beliefs, for he was very devoted to the special God of Israel. He told me much about what he called the one true God and about his covenant with Abraham. Then the day came we had dreamed and talked of. Mahlon and his father came to speak to my father and brothers to ask for me in marriage. The dowry was paid, announcements made, and I, Ruth, was betrothed to Mahlon. Preparations began. The groom-to-be and his father built a house and the furnishings. Meanwhile, my mother and sisters spent extra time weaving, spinning, and sewing my special wedding garments. The months passed in a whirlwind of activities, daydreams, laughter, and the usual wedding worries and concerns. We were young, my mom and I, but we were deeply in love, and after our wedding, we would be together always. Ours would be a happy home, filled with the laughter of many children. Our little ones would be a godly seed, raised in a loving home, raised under the laws and love of the God of Israel. We would teach our children about his ways as we sat with them in our house, when we walked along the village paths. We would say our morning and evening prayers together. Yes, it was our prayer too that we could teach others, especially my family, of his ways. Not for us, Mama and me, for the ways of Chemosh. Our children would not be sacrificed to the huge fiery idol, Chemosh. I had first seen this done when I was a young girl, and the horror of the sight and the wails of the baby and the cheers of the crowd haunted me yet. Mahlon had told me that God had promised a special son, one who would heal all the hurts brought on in the Garden of Eden, a son who would bring life. Would it be? What a glorious thought that Mahlon and I might be the parents of this special one, the one destined to be king of all Israel. Our wedding day dawned with the pale orange and gold light of the sun. Doves cooed softly in the nearby olive grove. Somewhere a dog barked, and our village slowly came to life. Before the sun would rise again, I would be Ruth, wife of Mahlon, son of Elimelech and Naomi, children of Israel. Meanwhile, there was work to be done, and as the day progressed, the noise and bustle increased. Then suddenly it was evening, and time for the bridegroom and his friends to arrive. Near midnight, the cries were heard. Here's the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. The glow of their lamps brightened the dark night. The bridegroom's procession arrived at my parents' home, and I was presented in my bridal array to my husband. All accompanied us to our new home, where there was feasting long into the night. Our life as husband and wife had begun. The days spoke together in endless happiness and joy. All was well. Spring and fall rains arrived as expected. Harvests were rich and plentiful, and I was content in my new life.
Were the two young Israelite men wrong to marry women of Moab? The question is not an easy one. It leads to other questions. Were there Israelite women to marry in Moab? Possibly, but we don't know for sure. Could Mahlon and Chilion have sent back to their tribe or their clan in Israel to take brides, as Abraham had done for Isaac? Would the families of such potential brides have allowed young women to go to the land of Moab? We don't know. Did Orpah and Ruth convert to the Israelite faith before marrying? Later events suggest they did, although we might have cause to question Orpah's sincerity. Perhaps this is the bottom line. The first wrong, going to Moab, led inexorably to what might be the next wrongs, the marrying of Moabite women. This is a feature of that downward spiral that we see in Scripture. The first step leads to the second step, and after a while the third step doesn't look so bad until we have moved ourselves completely into a position that at the beginning we would never have chosen. It's worth asking, as parents, do we sometimes make choices for ourselves and our families that compel our children in later years to make wrong choices for themselves in ways that we might never have planned or expected? Something to think about. So, bearing in mind that everything here is not black and white, we may still consider Bible passages about marriage to non-believers. I'd like, first of all, to look at Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 1 through 4. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, and others that are listed there, seven nations larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them, show them no mercy. Do not, the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. Very powerful words. We might argue that these words are not directly relevant to the situations that we find ourselves in today. But certainly there are principles here worth bearing in mind wherever we go and whatever we do. In Ezra chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, there is a similar statement. Ezra 9, 1 and 2. After these things had been done, the leaders came to me and said, these are the words of Ezra, the people of Israel, including the priests and the Levites, have not kept themselves separate from the neighboring peoples with their detestable practices, like those of the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, and here's the whole list again, except there is also added the Ammonites and the Moabites. They have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, and have mingled the holy race with the peoples around them, and the leaders and officials have led the way in this unfaithfulness. So the Moabites come in for a special prohibition in this statement in Ezra. And then there is the passage in Deuteronomy 23, and I think it's worth looking at now, and we'll probably come back to it again, because it's like an underlying theme in the story of Ruth, a question, an ongoing question as we continue the story. Deuteronomy 23, verse 3. I think I put on the board verses 1 through 3, but really it's verse 3 that we're aiming for. No Ammonite or Moabite or any of his descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord, even down to the 10th generation. Now, here is a very powerful prohibition. Even down to the 10th generation, which may or may not imply to all perpetuity. You know, that is perhaps subject to interpretation. And this brings up a question. Was Ruth still a Moabite after her marriage, or when she married, and then after her marriage? Was Ruth, by this law, prohibited from entering the congregation of the Lord? Well, this and similar questions have arisen, and various answers or suggestions have been propounded. Maybe the most obvious to suggest is that Ruth was really a converted Jew and no longer a Moabitess. This is interesting because she continues to be called a Moabitess right through the story and on into the New Testament. She is Ruth the Moabitess. So, a little perplexing point there. Perhaps it can be resolved. Others have suggested that this verse applies to males, but not to females. A Moabite man was to be excluded to the 10th generation, but not necessarily women. However, the verse does say any of the descendants. So again, this is a little shaky. Maybe so. Maybe this is the way it could be read. Or, in the case of Ruth, had 10 generations passed from the time the original statement, the original prohibition, had been made through Moses? Well, it probably takes a little stretching, or maybe I should say a little squeezing, to get as many as 10 generations in between the time of Moses and the time of Ruth. But maybe that's the way to read the passage. And all of these are questions that we can ponder as we consider this seemingly very powerful prohibition. No Moabite, no descendant of a Moabite can enter the congregation of the Lord unto the 10th generation. And you can choose amongst those as you feel comfortable. And we may have more to say about that later, but I'd like you to think about that as we go along. It must be noticed, however, that great good in the subsequent life of Ruth came out of what might be perceived as a wrong on the part of Mahlon, the wrong of marrying an alien. Is it okay to do something that is wrong if, in fact, everything turns out well in the end? How do we know how things are going to turn out in the end? The Apostle Paul in Romans paraphrases those who say, "Let us do evil that good may come." And he says, that course is very wrong and is to be condemned. So, something else to think about. And perhaps you've noticed that I'm not giving you any definite answers at this point, and I may not. It seems to me that one of the interesting aspects of Scripture is that we can derive for ourselves any number of questions, and we can think about those questions without necessarily arriving at absolute and perfect answers, at least at the beginning. That part of our sojourn in life is to consider questions time after time and develop our own answers and find that which satisfies us, but we're never perhaps perfectly satisfied because we should continue pondering these things. One of the lessons that arises from this, it seems to me, is that life is filled with gray areas. We should thank God we don't have to judge all of our brothers' actions, that we don't have to be judge and jury and come to a perfect understanding of the guilt of every other individual and how he or she should be punished. We should especially thank God that we don't have to judge the thoughts and the motives of others. The actions can be hard enough to understand. And we should thank God that we can leave it to him to do the right thing in judging each of his servants. Romans 14 verse 4 says, "Who are you to judge another man's servant?"
I was blessed to have such a mother-in-law as Naomi. She was always available to listen and to work with me. Naomi told me again and again of God's covenant with his friend Abraham and of special promises of the land of Canaan for an everlasting inheritance to Abraham and his children. All this, but Abraham and Sarah had no sons or daughters. And in those few years we had together as husband and wife, Mom and I hoped for a son or daughter to be born to us. But month after month and year after year passed, and no baby filled our empty arms. Naomi was a comfort here too, because she would remind me of how Sarah and Rebecca had waited for many years. So we waited too, confident that our Father would bless us in his own time. Then one day our real troubles began. Mahlon came home from the field to tell me that Elimelech had been taken home ill. We ran the short distance to Naomi and Elimelech's home. Naomi's eyes were filled with concern. We sat there with her, and as the evening deepened into night, our Elimelech's sleep deepened into death. In the hours and days that followed, we, his children, went about our task with unfeeling bodies. Our family head had been taken from us so quickly and without any warning. Naomi alone was a pillar of strength. She fully believed that God's people would sleep the sleep of death for a while, and that one day he would awaken them in a resurrection at the last day. She knew that the righteous were taken away from the evil to come. And so we wondered what the future held for us, the living. As the year came to a close, sorrow and calamity struck us again. This time it was Kilian. Our grief was felt by our entire village. Why did this happen to us? First Elimelech, and now Kilian. Mahlon only was left to carry the family name. Somehow we survived another funeral. The new year brought little joy or hope. Of late I had noticed changes in Mahlon, and I was secretly alarmed. But who could I tell? News was beginning to reach our village of better times in Israel. Some families talked of returning. But for us, returning was impossible. Mahlon was much worse, despite rest and medication. Finally, the inevitable end came. It was a farewell I had never, ever expected to say. But at the very last, it was almost a relief. Now we three were left alone. Once so full, happy, and content, we were now so empty, dressed in widow's clothing and nearly destitute. The God of Israel had given and had taken away. I clung to this thought, and therefore I had hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we have not been consumed, for his compassions never fail. They renew every morning in many little ways. So I said to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him. Malan's last days had been long, painful ones. Now my days were long, and my nights even longer. Morning, I wished for evening. At evening, I wished for morning. Sounds would revive happy moments. The barking of a dog is on my wedding horn. The crying of a baby, which reminded me of the little ones we had hoped for but never had. A sunrise or sunset would stir up sweet memories. For a fleeting moment, I would find happiness. I longed for Mama's strong arms to hold me and to assure me that all was well, that I had just had a bad dream. But there was no Mama, only the bad dreams, and so much emptiness in my life.
We began to think about the relationship between Naomi and Ruth in this story. And this relationship will develop and flourish as we move through the story. This friendship between the two is a beautiful and sensitive picture, and a subtle picture full of nuances and questions. Naomi is seen, first of all, as a party to her husband's apostasy, the falling away to Moab. Along with her husband, she leaves Israel to go to Moab. She suffers greatly in the foreign land, losing her husband, losing her two sons, losing, it would seem, all hope. And by her own admission, she becomes a bitter woman. She uses this word to describe herself as we read through the story. I am a bitter woman. Yet despite the failings and the sufferings, there is something in Naomi that still attracts the attention and devotion of Ruth. Ruth, who has experienced her own great loss. Can it be this? That a person who has endured such hardship, yet who can still believe in the God who in some sense brought those sufferings upon her, is a person whose word, whose thoughts are to be listened to. In contrast, perhaps, to another person who might have lived a quite easy and comfortable life. Through her sufferings that left her bitter, Naomi still believed in the one God who was responsible for bringing those sufferings on her. That is a powerful thought and a powerful exhortation. In a sense, Naomi reminds us of the man Job with his sufferings. Is this the key? Is this why a loving father chastens his children? Hebrews chapter 12, verse 5. The word of encouragement, the word of exhortation, my son, my daughter, do not make light of the Lord's discipline. Do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes everyone he accepts as a son. Endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as a son or a daughter. For what child is not disciplined by the father? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you're illegitimate children and not true sons and daughters. Moreover, we have all had human fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them for it. How much more should we submit to the Father of our spirits and live? Our fathers disciplined us for a little while as we thought best, but God disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness. No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. I am a bitter woman, Naomi says. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained by it. And the harvest of righteousness and peace comes not just to Naomi, but to Ruth, the young woman, the woman of Moab, the woman who worshiped false gods and yet comes at last to the true God of Israel. And through Naomi and through her sufferings, she sees a way and a path that she might travel to find peace and satisfaction and security. One other passage, 2 Corinthians chapter 1, and a few verses there. Interesting how the New Testament passages bear on the Old Testament stories. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles, so that we may comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves have received from God. And see how this passes on from one to another. Naomi suffering, yet being comforted by the faith that she had, and this example of Naomi being passed on to Ruth, so that she can see mirrored in Naomi how one should react. Even though life is bitter, even though trials have been hard, excruciatingly hard, yet there is still room for comfort. There is still room for hope and faith beyond. The God who can bring suffering is the God who can bring comfort to those who trust in him. And so here is a reason, a rationale for the sufferings, the chastening that we all experience. There is a thin line between despair and faith, between affliction and compassion. Naomi stood on that line and looked both ways, at despair and then at hope, and she chose God. Ruth observed her mother-in-law, and having experienced her own personal and heart-wrenching losses, her experiences were coupled with her observations, and it helped her to choose the way of faith against all odds. Tomorrow we shall begin to see how this was accomplished in the story of Ruth.